In the matter of Gloria Colon versus Strategic Delivery Solutions, LLC, can we please have appearances of counsel? Mr. Sadaraju, please go ahead.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. First, I'd like to start off by thanking you for the opportunity to present oral argument on this important issue.
Just try to keep your voice up. If you
sure. I was had a cold last week. I apologize. I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to argue on this important issue. In this court's numerous arbitration opinions, certain unshakable principles have emerged. One fundamental principle is that a party's waiver of statutory rights must be clearly and unmistakably established, and contractual language to constitute a waiver will not be read expansively. That was held in Garfinkel. The waiver should be reflect that the employee understands the type of claims included in the waiver. These requirements were reinforced in Attlees, and more recently in Moon v. Breathless, the Third Circuit refused to enforce an arbitration clause in a New Jersey wage and hour law, wage payment law class action, because the agreement did not mention a waiver of statutory rights. The basic and easily met requirements for arbitration agreements established by this court could not be more clear. Yet respondent forced petitioners to sign a wholly non-compliant agreement in this case. There's no mention whatsoever that petitioners would be waiving their statutory rights, nor is there any mention or description of the types of claims waived, such as a mention of statutory employment rights. Moreover, the provision includes a grossly unconscionable term that the individuals have to pay the fees and costs of the arbitrator, which this court addressed in Delta Funding Corp. Under this court's decisions in Garfinkel, and Attlees, and Morgan, as well as the Third Circuit's opinion in Moon, the arbitration provision in this case should be declared void on its face. As in the appellate division's, another clear error the appellate division made can be reduced to perhaps a single sentence. The parties should have understood that the NJAA would apply to their agreement. That was a slip opinion on page 11. This sentence and the idea behind it runs counter to this court's extensive jurisprudence on contract formation provisions. Contract formation principles underlying arbitration agreements. In Garfinkel, this court held that it must look to the language of the clause to establish boundaries and that a court may not rewrite a contract to broaden the scope of the arbitration. In this case, the well-defined boundaries of the contract state up front that the agreement is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act. The court has further held that a fundamental tenet of contract law is that courts will not make a different or better contract than the parties themselves have seen fit to enter into. Again, in this case, this is exactly what the appellate division did. By inserting the New Jersey arbitration into this agreement, because after defendants appealed, sought to invoke that law when they didn't like the result that came out of the Federal Arbitration Act, which is what they negotiated for. The doctrine of mutual assent, as this court discussed in Attlees, stands for the simple but powerful notion that a legally enforceable contract requires a meeting of the minds. It requires that the parties have an understanding of the terms to which they've agreed. There was no meeting of the minds between the parties in this case as to whether the New Jersey Arbitration Act would apply in lieu of the Federal Arbitration Act. As such, New Jersey Arbitration Act simply cannot be read into or presumed into this agreement. We submit that the terms of this agreement are clear and that under the governing FAA, no arbitration can proceed under the United States Supreme Court's decision in New Prime. To the extent anyone asserts that there is confusion or ambiguity about what law governs, under this court's precedent in Roach v. BM Motoring, that ambiguity should be construed against arbitration and against the drafter. In Roach, this court held, if the meaning of an arbitration provision is ambiguous, the provision should be construed against the drafter because as a drafter, it chose the words that may be susceptible to different meaning. Under these clear contract principles, arbitration should not be permitted. Under FAA established precedent, also does not permit the reading in of the New Jersey Arbitration Act. Under a Third Circuit precedent, it is, quote, it is well established that absent clear intent to apply a non-FAA standard, the FAA standard is to be applied. There's no indication whatsoever in this very short provision that there was any intent for the NJAA to apply. And then, in Aria, that was reinforced in Aria, where the Third Circuit held, the FAA standards control in the absence of contractual intent to the contrary. The court further ignored Third Circuit precedent that a generic choice of law clause standing alone is insufficient to support a finding the contracting parties intended to opt out of the FAA's default. The final error an additional error the appellate division made was that it ignored this court's controlling opinion in the Muhammad case, because this agreement is further void on this grounds. In Muhammad, this court held that class waivers are unconscionable in light of the strong public policy in the state of New Jersey underlying class actions, as articulated in the court's opinion in Iliadis v. Walmart and other cases. The appellate division's twofold basis for ignoring Muhammad were that this case does not involve a consumer contract, and second was that they questioned the validity of Muhammad. This approach was deeply flawed on numerous fronts. First, Muhammad's holding or analysis was not limited to consumer contracts. In fact, the holding and analysis that they used in Muhammad is perhaps even more important in the employment context, whereas this court recognized in Iliadis that single employees are less likely to come forward to question illegal employment practices because they fear retaliation, and that the issue of small individual claims may not be brought before the court because profitable to do that, or if it's not conducive for that.
May I ask a question before we get too deep into the weeds on Muhammad?
Sure.
I want to go back to some of the other points that
Absolutely.
You were making. On the question of mutual assent, was there an agreement to arbitrate, to resolve matters through arbitration? Set aside which law applies. Is that something where there was a meeting of the minds?
Your Honor, before we get to mutual assent, this agreement's void. The agreement's void.
I understand your positions. We've read your papers. This is an area I'd like you to focus on, if you
yes.
could.
There's no mutual assent here, Your Honor, because the parties agreed to arbitrate under certain terms. One of the terms they would be governed by in terms of how arbitration's that's a big term. A lot goes into that.
So let's look at the language of the agreement itself. Section 20A.
Yes.
Put aside the first sentence. Does the second sentence, which says the parties agree that any dispute, ... shall be subject to binding arbitration, and then it talks about the AAA rules, does that indicate that there was a meeting of the minds that disputes would be resolved by arbitration?
No, because the language of what would be arbitrated did not make reference to statutory employment claims. And there was no agreement, in terms of what you're agreeing to arbitrate, this isn't a breach of contract case. If this is a breach of contract case, the answer to the question would be yes, could potentially be yes. But this is a statutory case.
I want you to set aside your argument about
right.
whether the statutory claim is covered.
Right.
I'm asking a different question.
Okay.
It's a general question about whether there's mutual assent that, assume it covers any and all disputes, would go to arbitration. Does the language in 20 indicate that in the second sentence? Is that the intent of the parties?
Putting aside the other, there was an intent for certain claims. I mean, again, I don't want to get into that. You don't want to get into that, but to be pursued in arbitration. I understand that that could be argued.
So then, look at the severability clause at 24, which says, if the FAA is unenforceable, ask whether there's mutual assent to modify an agreement to most nearly retain the intent of the parties.
Well, it says if any provision shall be agreement, shall be illegal or enforceable.
Do you modify the agreement to match the intent of the parties? And that's why I was asking you, was the intent of the parties to go to arbitration in this case?
But I guess what I'm struggling with the question, Your Honor, is that the concept of going to arbitration, that entails a lot of different things in terms of what's being, and again, it's a very limited question, but in terms of how it's going to be governed, what rules are going to be governed, how it's going to proceed. All those things go into factor in terms of whether or not you're giving a, you're engaging in mutual assent.
So is it your position that it boils down to, listen, you have to use the FAA. That's the only, that's the exclusive way that this case can proceed. End of story.
The FAA is the only thing that was bargained for between the parties, and that's the law that should be proceeding. Yes.
Okay. Where's the language that you rely on that the FAA is the exclusive means of proceeding?
The parties agree and to comply and be bound by the Federal Arbitration Act. There was no other legal framework that was the legal framework that was to be agreed upon.
And you give greater weight to that phrase than to any of the other phrases in the agreement.
Well, the Federal Arbitration Act, because, again, there have to be rules in terms of how this process is to be governed and how the parties are going to proceed.
So I think this would be helpful. What is the distinction between the FAA and the NJAA? Is there any, do you see any distinction in the application of one over the other?
Well, it clearly, under the FAA, under Section 1, these category workers, the law provides that they're exempt for the public, for the, as per the intent of Congress.
Other than that, because the Chief Justice was pointing out that the language suggested that they wanted to arbitrate. So obviously, if Section 1 of the FAA applies to interstate transportation worker, we know that the FAA is off the table. Putting aside that, assume that we're dealing with Section 2 of the FAA and the NJAA. Are there any distinctions in the way that one would they would apply to this case?
Well, in terms of the difference in the procedures, I don't think there's a major distinction, but...
Okay, so I'm going to suggest one.
Okay.
Class action waivers. We know that there is United States Supreme Court precedent.
Correct.
That it knocks out class action waivers, at least in the consumer context, under the FAA, but that wouldn't necessarily be true under the NJAA. So
right.
to whatever extent the Muhammad decision may be preempted under federal law, it's certainly not preempted under state law.
No.
And this arbitration agreement, as I've read it, suggests that there's a class action waiver, and under our state law, under Muhammad, that would be barred. And that would seem to be a major distinction between the two. And I suppose there's some argument. Well, we don't know whether or not the parties agreed whether or not there would be class action waiver or not, because it's in there. It's barred under this New Jersey law. That's another confounding factor if you take the FAA out of the picture, no?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And the other issue is that there's so many terms in here in this agreement that are essentially make it void. In terms of the lack of knowing, in terms of their statutory rights, not describing the rights, all these things, the court's prior jurisprudence would invalidate all these agreements.
I'm going to go back to something you said in your opening statement. You said that the NJAA was not selected. Now, the NJAA applies to all arbitration agreements entered into after January 1, 2003, correct? It's by its own terms. That's what it says.
The law states that, but the...
Right, hold on.
Sorry.
Just
I didn't mean
stick
to...
with the question.
Sure.
It says that, right? So is it your contention that parties have to say in an arbitration agreement, we agree that the NJAA applies in order to have the NJAA apply?
If the parties yes, because if the parties
okay, so
say,
this is all any arbitration agreement in New Jersey that doesn't say we agree the NJAA applies, it doesn't apply to. That's your contention.
That's also what the Third Circuit's held in repeated opinions, was that absent a clear intent to apply a non-FAA standard, the FAA standard is to be applied.
No, FAA, I'm not asking about. I'm asking about whether the NJAA applies to arbitration agreements by default, even if not specifically prescribed in the agreement.
No, they don't, because if it's not mentioned, the FAA is the default standard that's utilized, and that's what the Third Circuit has repeatedly held they held that recently in the Ario case.
But when the FAA doesn't apply, you're saying that unless the NJAA is specifically named, it has no impact on an arbitration agreement.
Correct.
That's your position.
It needs to be bargained for, because there is a preemption position here in terms of Congress intended for the FAA to apply. Congress intended for a category of workers to not be subject to arbitration. To the extent the NJAA is in conflict with that, the NJAA would not.
When Congress excludes a group of employees from the FAA, and therefore the FAA does not apply, and obviously there's a dispute on that in your case, but if that's the case, you say that the NJAA has to be specifically named in order to be applicable, notwithstanding the language in it that says it applies to all arbitration agreements.
Yes, because the law states, the law under the FAA states, and if there is no mention of it, the FAA as a default applies. In terms of whether or not transportation workers would be covered by the FAA, Congress intended for those categories of workers that they did not want them subject to arbitration.
Well, that's your contention with respect to what Congress did, but isn't it more that Congress was acknowledging that there were specific categories of transportation workers as to whom there were other programs for resolving their disputes? Isn't that really what was behind that?
There was that Congress had the right to want to designate what processes would be in place for those workers, and that they did not. There was also concern about issues of volatility or issues of these workers were crucial workers, and that they did not want them subject to arbitration.
Let me ask you a question about on preemption. I'm trying to wrap my head around this. 1925, Congress enacts the Federal Arbitration Act. It specifically excludes workers in interstate commerce and transportation workers in interstate commerce, and it excludes them from arbitration under the FAA. Perhaps in part because at least some of those interstate workers are subject to federal arbitration or alternate dispute resolution procedures. I'm trying to understand this. If Congress was barring itself from interfering with those arbitration acts, why would it permit the states to interfere with them through their own arbitration acts?
They wouldn't be permitted.
So do you have a preemption argument?
Yes,
I want to hear it.
The preemption argument is that Congress did not want these categories of workers subject to arbitration, whether it was through the FAA. It would invalidate the intent of Congress if you can say, all right, we're not going to do it through the FAA, but you can do it through the New Jersey Act.
Where do you get that from? Legislative history, the language itself, or is that just your argument, your interpretation?
It's my interpretation. It's also based on
Congress. Because I don't see it anywhere else other than your interpretation.
But Congress has said that they wanted to be...
If Section 20 said the parties agreed to comply and be bound by the NJAA rather than federal, would this be a valid arbitration agreement?
Arguably not, because the Congress did not want these categories of workers to be subject to it. And Congress...
Are you suggesting that FALCO is no longer good law?
No, because I think that when Congress... The issue of New Pride hadn't been decided at the time FALCO came in. The issue is that if Congress intends for a group of workers not to be subject to arbitration, then Congress controls the field of arbitration. To the extent that states are interfering with congressional intent in the area of arbitration, then the state law would be...
There are numerous cases around the country that go exactly opposite to the position that you're arguing.
I understand that, but I'm saying in terms of this act, in terms of where we are, I don't think...
And do you see anything in New Prime that supports that statement? Because Justice Gorsuch did not reach that issue pointedly.
He pointedly did not reach the issue.
I've heard you make two arguments, and I want you to try to reconcile. One is that there's no mention of the NJAA here, so there's no meeting of the minds as to it. But your other argument is that it would have been impossible or contrary to your understanding of preemption to have a provision in this contract that said the FAA applies, and if it doesn't, the NJAA would apply. Are you advancing both of those positions to us today?
Perhaps I misheard your question.
Could this agreement have been drafted to say the FAA applies, and if it does not, New Jersey state law applies? Would that have been an appropriate agreement?
There would be an intent there for purpose of mutual assent, but in terms of preemption, the case would still be subject to the intent of Congress for these categories of workers to not have to.
So all of the case law that Justice Lavecchia alluded to, including case law since New Prime, that has that language, you're saying they got it wrong.
I'm saying that position to proceed under state law would be inconsistent with the intent of Congress to allow those.
And your argument there is, if Congress was not going to permit the FAA to interfere with then in 1925, then some congressional alternative dispute resolutions, like why on earth would the Congress permit the state to do the very thing that it wouldn't do?
Exactly.
Did you argue that in this case?
Where do you get from the FAA that intends to stop arbitration if an employee is not covered by the FAA? Because the whole thrust of the FAA is to make sure there's no anti-arbitration law at work in a state jurisdiction, for example, that might conflict with the FAA. It promotes a policy supportive of arbitration. You seem to be now kind of flipping it on its head to say that it's now going to block any other pro-arbitration law that exists around the country. And I just don't see where you get that from the fact that a class of employees may not be subject to language that's favorable to arbitration under the FAA. It's an extension I'm having trouble wrapping my head around.
Because I agree that the FAA wants, the policy behind the FAA is to promote arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
But in Section 1, they clearly carved out categories of workers who they did not want subject to that policy.
No, they just said that the FAA doesn't apply to them.
Correct.
It doesn't say that they doesn't want them to be subject to arbitration agreements. There's nothing in the FAA that makes that kind of a statement. And that is, in essence, what Judge Sloviter wrote in Palco. And the reason why I asked if you're arguing Palco, is Palco no longer good law? She said you read that exemption as if the FAA just doesn't exist, and you examine the arbitration agreement to see if on its own there still is a sufficient intent to demonstrate mutual assent. She found it in that Palco case. We have to now, I think, examine whether or not there's sufficient evidence in this language of this contract to evidence mutual assent, regardless of what the FAA says, if this employee is not subject to them.
Well, again, I know we're not talking about the issue we have here is which the point Justice Salmon was making, which is the point I'm trying to make, is that Congress intended for these workers not to be subject to arbitration due to various policies.
No, you're misstating my question. Congress simply said a class of employees is not subject to the FAA's pro-arbitration language. It doesn't say that class of employees may not be subject to arbitration agreements, period, unless you can point to me some language in the FAA that says that, other than the definitional term exempting a class of employees.
But under that reading, if the workers could be subject to other state arbitrations, what would be the purpose of exempting them from the Federal Arbitration Act?
Are there other mechanisms under federal law for dispute resolution outside of the FAA that would apply to interstate commerce employees and interstate commerce?
Not that I'm aware of.
How about federal contract principles? How about ordinary contract? The FAA didn't invent, as old as it is, mm-hmm. The FAA didn't invent arbitration. Arbitration existed before the arbitration agreements by contract existed before the FAA, and if the FAA didn't exist, there would be arbitration agreements that are dealt with under contract principles. So when Congress says under Section 1 this group is out, it is out of, as Justice Lebecki was referencing, all of the very strong pro-arbitration policies, including the law that's developed in recent years about not imposing on arbitration contract terms that don't apply to other contracts, that is out. But the fact that does not mean that you can't arbitrate. You end up under federal law, if a case were governed by federal law, be dealing with contract principles.
Even if we're dealing with contract principles, I mean, again, we're as a threshold matter for in terms of where this provision fails. This provision fails under the contract principles articulated by this court in Garfinkel and Attlees for it not being knowing.
It doesn't Do you contest that there was a New Jersey law was chosen by the parties in this agreement in a choice of law provision?
There was a governing law section, yes.
Well, I agree there was, but do you contest that the governing law section chose New Jersey law?
It did choose New Jersey law.
I'm sorry, it did?
Yes.
Okay.
So
New Jersey law, substantive law of New Jersey, governs this contract, correct?
Correct.
Unless preempted by federal law.
Correct.
And if you're correct that your client is out of the FAA under Section 1, then we are to look at this as a contract governed. It stands or falls under New Jersey law, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, in all New Jersey contracts, by its own terms, but for preemption, the NJAA sets some rules. Now, it doesn't set rules of procedure like the AAA rules. It doesn't set substantive law, as contract law or otherwise, but it sets some basic premises about how arbitrations are going to be handled. Why isn't that in this case? Because your client signed an agreement choosing New Jersey law.
Well, this, again, as a threshold issue, but in terms of what under New Jersey contract law, this entire provision needs to be struck under this court's opinion in Garfunkel and Attlees for the fact that they did not mentioned that this was a waiver of statutory rights. They did not describe the nature of the rights being waived.
You're addressing a different question. I'm talking now about your contention that the NJAA is out of this case. And I think in answering other questions, you said the NJAA should not be considered in this case.
Yes.
So when the parties agreed, New Jersey, they don't say it quite this way. They have a reference to the home state of the defendants. But when the parties agreed to New Jersey law, why didn't they agree to NJAA unless preempted?
Well, the Third Circuit addressed this issue in REO, and they said a generic choice of law clause standing alone is insufficient to support a finding that the contracting parties intended to opt out of the FAA's default standards.
That's a different question.
Is it your position that the parties had a right to decide what statutory scheme would apply? They decided the FAA.
Correct.
They may very well have excluded the NJAA for whatever reasons they may have had. And unless it's clear and unambiguous that they wanted the NJAA, which isn't in the contract,
we
shouldn't be inserting it. Is that your argument?
That's my argument, yeah, under the contract.
So we ignore a state statute that says the NJAA governs every arbitration agreement in New Jersey after January 1st, 2003.
But as a matter of contract principles, two private entities entered into a contract. They chose the governing law of what they would decide they wanted to be governed by, and they named one statutory scheme. They named only the FAA.
But the FAA is not in conflict with another statute that is pro-arbitration, like the NJAA. It is designed to block other statutes that interfere with enforcement of the arbitration process that the federal government is promoting through the FAA. So you're assuming a false conflict, I suggest, in answering that question, are you not?
It's not a false conflict to the extent that they're seeking different results out of two different statutes. That's what they're seeking.
There may be different results under. Class action waivers are not permitted under federal law. Class are permitted under federal law. They're presumably prohibited under the NJAA if Muhammad applies.
Correct.
So, I mean, so we would have substantive differences between the application of the NJAA and the FAA.
Correct. And as another matter of course is that...
But you're saying that what Justice Alban just said doesn't apply because the NJAA is out of the case. That's your position.
No, that's not. I'm not saying it's out of the case, but you're asking, is there a difference between these two schemes? Or are they not in conflict with each other? I'm saying the results of what statutory scheme you use would present a conflict in terms of what the results are between
the application of them both.
But
you've been telling us throughout your argument the NJAA doesn't govern this contract.
I'm arguing that the NJAA doesn't govern the contract because it wasn't bargained for. Number two, okay. If it's to the extent it's in conflict with the FAA in terms of what categories of employees. Second, that's
So Justice Alban's question about the application of Muhammad, you're saying NJAA is out.
I'm not saying the application of Muhammad isn't contingent on the FAA. The FAA is out. If the FAA is out, then this contract, the class waiver provision still stands.
You're saying there's no meeting of the minds if the FAA is out. That's your argument, stripped to its essence.
Yes. Right. I mean, there's no mutual assent if they don't mention that.
I want to come back to the questions about preemption. I asked if Congress had set up other mechanisms to resolve these disputes, and you said no. Are you familiar with this language from Circuit City Stores? Congress had already enacted federal legislation providing for the arbitration of disputes between seamen and their employers, and grievance procedures existed for railroad employees under federal law. Does that suggest that Section 1 of the FAA bars arbitration or that it was otherwise provided for?
I said I wasn't aware of any particular statutory arbitration scheme that applied other than that would apply.
Assume that language is language from the Supreme Court decision in Circuit City.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your question being that is that I'm not understanding.
Doesn't that suggest that Section 1 of the FAA is not an absolute bar to arbitration, but it's simply saying this section, this language in the FAA doesn't apply to this category of workers. Others may, not this.
No, the way I read New Prime was that this category of workers was not subject to arbitration. That's the way it, and was not subject to the
Well, that doesn't answer the follow-up question. And that is whether it bars any effort at arbitration for this category of workers.
I think what I was discussing with Justice Allen before, yes, I think it would, because Congress did not intend for those workers to be subject to the arbitration process.
Unless Congress said so. So if Congress made exceptions, that's one thing. But would Congress have wanted the states to be interfering with specially designed alternate dispute resolution programs that it developed?
No, it would not.
Probably not.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just one brief thing, and I know I'm coming to rebuttal. As the what I started with is really what I want to focus in. This court, I understand there's interesting issues in terms of the preemption issue, in terms of the interaction with the NJAA. There's a threshold issue in terms of whether or not people in the state of New Jersey signing this agreement. This agreement ran afoul of Garfinkel, it ran afoul of Attlees, and even as articulated by the Third Circuit, Mouton v. Breathless. This provision is void. So I understand there's all these other issues that are coming up that were presented to the court, but as a threshold matter, I just want to reiterate that this contract was unconscionable and it should not be permitted to proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Wright. Mr. Wright.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. William Wright for Amici New Jersey Association for Justice. I would like to start out by echoing the rhetorical question that Justice Alban asked, which came to me late last night as all these cases were swirling in my head and I was reading the briefs and petitions again.
Did you hear his voice in the night? That's
unfortunately, sometimes I do.
Unfortunately, sometimes I do too.
But when I heard it, It asks the same
question. I'm fast asleep, I want you to know, while you guys are dreaming.
But the voice did come to me.
Tell us the question.
And it did ask the same question. Why on earth would Congress exempt federal courts and federal law from interfering with these other dispute resolution measures, either existing or contemplated for these kinds of workers? Why would they say the federal courts can't touch this, but the 50 states have at it? To answer the specific question that Justice Ravner had about the other dispute resolution avenues that were alluded to in the Circuit City case, the Railroad Employees Act, the Commissioner of Shipping's Arbitration Act. Later on came the addition of the air carriers to the Railroad Act. Those acts, reserved to the decision-making power of Congress, they do allow for arbitration for certain classes of transportation workers, but those acts have extremely detailed requirements for things that have to be in the agreement for arbitration itself, as well as how the arbitration is conducted, even how awards are given. I mean, the shipping commissioner, which one struck me, is that there's a cap on damages. The Railroad Act talks about that the parties have to agree in advance in writing on the number of people who are going to hear the arbitration.
I see your argument, but to me that would make sense if Congress had written in the FAA in Section 1, the transportation workers, and the definition was there, shall not be subject to arbitration, and were expressing a policy, it wouldn't matter what it was, the reasons for it, expressing a policy that a class of workers should be excluded from arbitration. But Congress knows, and certainly the many cases about the FAA has reflected, that what the FAA does is give a very strong boost to arbitration. It doesn't create the right to arbitration. Parties can still have arbitration without it. So when you say that there were these other mechanisms, but they were set specific requirements and so forth, are you telling us that Congress was saying these workers should be exempt from arbitration?
No, and Congress couldn't have said that when they enacted this in 1925, because these other statutes were in place. What Congress did when they said these workers are exempt from the application of the FAA is reserved to itself other ways to manage dispute resolution. Because remember, that's what Justice Gorsuch said in the Newbron opinion, which is that this stuff was heavily negotiated. There were union leaders, there was management, there were lobbyists, this was debated. These things came, and when I say these things, I mean these other dispute resolution procedures.
But you're just to be clear, because I think there's a distinction between you and your colleague in this regard. You're not saying that Congress was saying these workers should not be subjected to arbitration agreements. Someone could have had a private agreement that met contract law requirements, and that would be binding, correct? Even if they're out of the FAA.
Under these other statutes that exist for dispute resolution, sure, and I think
no, I'm not talking about those other statutes. I'm talking about a contractual, somebody's a transportation worker, a trucker who's not in any of these categories, could have a contract to arbitrate, even if that particular individual was not in the FAA.
So a person who is outside the Railroad Act, outside the Shipping and Commissioners
Act. Let's make
it
easy. Someone who's outside but is a transportation worker.
Okay.
Which is the contention of the plaintiff as to what his clients are.
Then I would argue that the FAA reserves to Congress itself the decision on how and whether those people who maybe aren't covered by these other acts, whether or not they can arbitrate, and if they're exempt from the FAA and all the pro-arbitration provisions of the FAA, I would argue that there's a conflict between an act.
So that you couldn't have truckers could not engage in a private contract to arbitrate. I'm not talking about collective bargaining.
Not if they're not covered by these other statutes. But remember, when the FAA enacted this, it wasn't just statutes that existed, but statutes that were contemplated. And that's what happened with the air carriers, who were ultimately added to the Railroad Act.
So what do you make of the language in New Prime, where at the close, Justice Gorsuch makes a point of saying he is only, and the court is only, dealing with a question of existing confusion about the application of the Arbitration Act, not to explore other potential avenues for reaching a destination that, in that case, the employer was seeking. Doesn't that go exactly to the issue that you're arguing now?
It does, and Justice Gorsuch has left us to tangle
right.
with that issue, at least for now.
Right, and there are, you know, I asked your co-counsel before, I'm moved by the fact that so many cases around the country have grappled with this very issue and have concluded that state's law that is advantageous to promoting arbitration is not in conflict and can proceed to be enforced in situations just like this.
I'm not unmoved by it, but a great insight, I guess, on that issue is actually the First Circuit's decision in the New Prime case that talks about the cascading decisions and it being a numbers game, and that's exactly what was happening with the application of this act to employees versus independent contractors. New Prime in the First Circuit said, this isn't a numbers game. Just because all of these cases are going this way doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right decision. Of course, we should consider it.
Isn't the answer that if there is a more precise arbitration or grievance process, such as the Chief Justice was talking about before, that is in conflict and preemptive of a contractual arbitration provision, those other statutory schemes will take care of themselves. But in the absence of those schemes coming to the fore, there is no conflict of preemption from the FAA's exclusion of a class of employees from the FAA's general pro-arbitration processes and other state laws that are also advantageous to encouraging enforcement of arbitration, contractual arbitration provisions. Is that not a fair way of putting together this whole body of law?
It may be fair, but I don't necessarily agree with it.
Tell me why.
And that's because Congress has seen fit to prohibit federal courts from touching transportation workers, whether they fall under one of these statutes or not, in the form of arbitration. Congress has said federal district court cannot compel arbitration. They don't have jurisdiction.
Under the FAA.
Correct.
Not under anything else.
But that begs the rhetorical question that I heard late in the night. Why would they disallow federal courts from doing this, but allow state courts, 50 of them, to muddy the waters on these issues that they wanted to reserve for themselves? They haven't yet.
The rhetorical question in the night being asked by my colleague, sub silencio, through you, is that we have to join together and view the exemption under the definitional clause of Section 1 as preemptive. And that is, I think, the nub of the question that the court must grapple with today.
And respectfully, I think the answer should be that to allow a state to force claims to arbitration that a federal statute says are not covered by, as the pro-arbitration folks would put it, by a statute that doesn't do anything other than present a pro-arbitration policy, I submit that it's more than that, that it's not just a statute that says, hey, we like arbitration. There are procedures. There is substance to it. And that's what the Moses Cone case says. Hey, this is supposed to be a body of federal substantive law.
Mm-hmm.
And if the substantive law says transportation workers are exempt, that conflicts with a state statute that allows state courts to compel arbitration of transportation workers' claims, whether or not they're covered by the Railroad Act, the Shipping Commissioners Act, the Air Carriers Act, or something that doesn't exist yet.
May I ask you a different question? Is it significant at all that this contractual provision mentions the FAA? Doesn't the FAA come into play in this question, whether it's in the contract or not, just as the New Jersey Arbitration Act does as well.
And that goes back
by operation of law.
That goes back to the meeting of the minds and the first bit of my argument that I haven't actually touched on yet. And the question is the paragraph in the Kernahan case where this court said basically the NJAA is the default rule. It's in dicta, but that's what this court said. It was a couple years ago.
The statute says it.
It's a default rule, Section 4.
The statute says it itself.
Unless it is superseded by the parties' agreement, which means the parties are free to insert another statute, another set of rules. In this case, they did. It just so happens that the statute that they superseded the NJAA with doesn't apply. It's not the same case as Flansman.
You think the FAA is speaking to procedural rules for arbitration? Doesn't the second and third sentences of this contractual provision answer that question? You're reading the FAA to say something other than it does. They're citing in this contractual agreement AAA rules.
That's correct.
For proceedings. Those are the kind of superseding agreements that can be reached and that are referenced in the NJAA.
But don't we have to read all the language in the contract together and give all these words meaning? In other words, if the parties agreed...
My question is purely this. Even if the FAA hadn't been mentioned, wouldn't we be bound to follow the FAA?
If the FAA hadn't been mentioned in this case, would we be bound to follow the FAA?
Yes.
No, because transportation workers are exempt. We'd be bound, arguably, to follow the NJAA.
So all of our decisions, whether or not the contractual provisions in Garfinkel and Martindale and all those other cases that our court has written in Adelaide, whether they mentioned the FAA or not, we engaged in unnecessary analysis by even considering the FAA?
No, because those cases didn't involve transportation workers. We would be engaging in unnecessary FAA analysis if we were applying FAA analysis, whether it's statutory or substantive case law that has come out of it since 1925, in the context of transportation workers, because they're exempted. And that goes back, I think,
The parties can agree. The parties, tell me if I'm mistaken, the parties can agree to the application of federal law or state law or that state law or this state law, that they're able to freely engage in that, correct?
Correct.
They apparently agreed that they were going to apply federal law, FAA.
Correct.
They didn't mention any other state law, correct? That may have been purposeful because it's not there. They could have put in the NJAA. Apparently they, at least the argument from counsel is, the one thing that we do know is that they agreed to the FAA.
Correct.
We've got three different kinds of issues here as I see it. We have, starting from the most mundane, the nuts and bolts of arbitration, and that's AAA under this agreement. Who does what, who pays what, all of the real stuff, but very nuts and bolts stuff that goes on in arbitration. Then we have substantive law that's chosen by the forum selection clause. The choice of law clause. That's New Jersey, okay? Then we have this, frankly, peculiar reference to the FAA, which doesn't provide the nuts and bolts of arbitration, which doesn't provide the substantive governing law that applies to the actual claims in the case, that provides important policies of Congress to promote arbitration, but it's very hard to see what the FAA would have even done in this case if your colleague didn't have an argument that his clients are out of it. See what I mean? The FAA says lots of good things about arbitration and says you can't burden arbitration by extra requirements. It states Congress's policy in favor of arbitration, but it has very little effect on the way the arbitration will proceed. Would you agree with that?
It has very little effect on how the arbitration should proceed, but it doesn't have no effect on how the arbitration should proceed. It has provisions providing for attendance of witnesses and for how the proceeding is to begin in the first place. So there are, it's a limited, I'll concede that, very limited procedural things, but it is procedural and substantive. There are both components to the FAA.
I think it's really odd to put FAA as governing law in an arbitration agreement. Do you agree?
Do I think it's odd? I mean, yes.
For lack of a better word?
Especially in a case where the type of worker involved is exempted from the FAA.
I understand that. That's good work on bringing your argument back to it. But no, in any FAA, AAA provides the procedures. People aren't going to be running to the FAA for guidance on that.
Well, I mean, do I think it's odd? So we've talked about this case. Obviously, it's in these parties' contracts. It was in the parties' contracts in the Palco case, right. Not to get ahead of myself, but it's in the other case that we're going to talk about a little later.
Yeah.
So is it odd?
I'm trying to say, what is it? It's not substantive governing law. It's not procedures. It doesn't really tell the parties what to do in this arbitration, if it applies.
It doesn't. It tells them what not to do. and that's the crux of the preemption argument, I think. And by the way, it's not lost on me that it is unique for me to be standing here arguing for FAA preemption. So it is a bit unique, and it is limited, obviously, to what we have here, which is the state statute would allow for something that the federal statute, I perceive, would not.
You've put forward a thoughtful argument on preemption. You read the appellate division decision. It's about whether there's mutual assent. It's about what the meaning of the contract is. I don't see much. I don't recall seeing anything about preemption there. I have a narrow question for you. When and how was the preemption issue presented in the courts that have wrestled with this case so far? And maybe Mr. McGovern can help us as well. Or is this coming to us now?
Are you talking about in these two cases?
In this case,
division?
The one that we're spending
this,
a good deal of time
case,
arguing. Was preemption raised as an argument? And when?
I believe it was raised in the appellate division. I assume the parties will be able to shed some more specific light on exactly how it was raised. But I believe it was raised in the appellate division. And it's really part and parcel to all of this, because we're dealing with two statutes that govern, and I can't see how that this wasn't raised below based on the briefs that I've read. I read the appellate division briefs. I just don't know off the top of my head.
I have two, and I don't have it with me, and that's why I was asking for your help. Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, no.
Do you have the answer?
Well, I have errors complained of in the petition. One of them is error three. The appellate division impermissibly rewrote the party's FAA exempted arbitration provision to improperly broaden the scope of arbitration. If that covers it,
that's the brief to us.
That's a big.
Yeah. I'm asking a different question. Maybe Mr. McGovern can help. Anything else you'd like to add?
I don't. Thank you,
Mr. McGovern.
Good morning, Your Honors. Let me address that last question. The answer is that question was not raised before the appellate division, nor during oral argument did the appellate division question the parties with respect to preemption.
Not in the briefs?
Not in the briefs, no.
And not in the trial court?
Not in trial court either.
So is it your position it's not before us?
It's not
case?
Before this court. And it would not have been raised before the trial court because that was pre-New Prime as well.
Yeah.
And that kind of informs as well the language that Your Honors see in the agreement. At the time that the parties entered into these agreements in 2015 and 2016, the law was not such that the Section 1 FAA exemption might have applied to these drivers. And I know Your Honors don't want to get into the question that I think I've preserved. There's been no discovery on the issue as to whether the plaintiff drivers in this case were engaged in interstate commerce. But I'm going to kind of stick to the certified question that the court has told the parties that it wants to hear about. Let me address some of the questions that have come up during the exchange with appellant's counsel, plaintiff's counsel. Our position, respondent's position, is that the agreements are enforceable under state law, whether it's going to be contract law or whether it's going to be New Jersey Arbitration Act, if the court finds that the Section 1 exemption does apply. Obviously, New Jersey public policy favors arbitration. The FAA does not preempt New Jersey Arbitration Act or New Jersey case law regulating in this area. And with respect to the legislative history regarding the Federal Arbitration Act, yes, there was an exemption made for workers engaged in foreign or interstate commerce, specifically because there were, as fellow counsel has already indicated, there were already statutory procedures in place or under contemplation under the Railway Labor Act to address those. But with respect to procedures for persons engaged in trucking in interstate or foreign commerce, I'm not aware that Congress was contemplating that at all. But let me mention the detail that Your Honors see in the arbitration agreement. As already mentioned, the parties provided for the applicability of AAA rules, the powers of the arbitrator, the locus of the arbitration, the allocation of costs, and by the way, the alleged unconscionability of shifting half of the fees to the plaintiff drivers, that has never been raised as an issue prior in below. Now, or the qualifications of the arbitrator. That is all prescribed in the arbitration agreement. And so just based on a contractual basis, separate and apart from whether the New Jersey Arbitration Act applies. And by the way, I took a look at the Attlee's decisions, the appellate division case, and the Supreme Court decision. I did not see any discussion of governing law in that case. So whether there has to be a governing law in order to trigger the applicability of New Jersey state contract law, I don't think that that is required. And with respect to whether there must be a governing law provision in a contract for the contract to be enforceable, we find no New Jersey case law holding along those lines. Now, the second part of the certified question, can the NJAA apply in place of the FAA? Yes, because notwithstanding counsel's argument that the appellate division rewrote the parties' agreement, the fact is that the appellate division enforced the parties' agreement. The parties specifically provided for an eventuality, just as you do in a separation agreement or a release agreement. Some court may find that there is a provision in this agreement that is no longer enforceable or it's void against public policy, so the parties' counsel provided for that and provided that in the event of an invalid or unenforceable provision, that provision will be reformed. And if reformation cannot be made, then that unenforceable provision should be severed. And I would also emphasize, there's just one reference in the entire agreement to the FAA. And you'll notice that the language used in this agreement is different from the language used in the Health Express agreement. It doesn't say, it's not in conflict with the governing law provision, simply that the parties agree to be bound by the FAA. There's a separate governing law provision that says New Jersey law will apply.
So let's stay with that sentence. It's the beginning of 20A. The parties agree to comply and be bound by the Federal Arbitration Act. That's literally what they agreed to.
Yes.
Where is their mutual assent beyond that?
There is none. There's no further mutual assent with respect to the FAA, if that's Your Honor's question.
Where is their mutual assent as to anything other than that?
The mutual assent goes on in significant detail in 20A with respect to the scope of the arbitration agreement, Your Honor. It goes into one of the issues that was hotly litigated in the courts below is this scope sufficient to include the statutory claims that the plaintiff drivers make right now?
So it has that, but it doesn't say that the NJAA will apply. So let me ask you this question. Could the parties have agreed that the FAA will apply, but we don't want the NJAA to apply? Because it's forget about Section 1. Arguably, under Section 2 of the FAA, class action waivers are fine in arbitration agreements. Arguably, under the NJAA, given our Muhammad decision, class action waivers are unconscionable. So what could the parties have decided the FAA is what we want, we don't want the NJAA applying?
They could have definitely written the contract that way, Your Honor.
So can someone read this contract to conclude that by the specific reference of the FAA and the specific exclusion of the NJAA, that's what the parties wanted.
I would say, Your Honor, I would refer the court to the Hirsch decision. And in the Hirsch decision, the language there is, contrary to what counsel is arguing, is that ambiguities with respect to an arbitration clause should be resolved in favor of arbitration. So to the extent that there is a conflict, and I wouldn't agree that there is a conflict given the clarity of the severability and reformation provision.
Do you agree that there's a mutual exclusion of NJAA anywhere expressed in that contract?
You
seem to agree to just seven that they applied the FAA to and expressly excluded the NJAA. Do you see that in the contract, the express exclusion of the NJAA?
No, there's absolutely no express exclusion
of
NJAA.
And is it the mutual assent at paragraph section 24, where they agree that they will agree to whatever makes a contract binding as an arbitration agreement? Isn't that the mutual assent to go to the NJAA?
That is our position. That is, and that's what the appellate division found, that the parties clearly intended and understood that in the event that the FAA was found to be unenforceable, that the NJAA would come in and fill the interstices, fill the gaps, fill where the FAA had been stricken.
So what happens to the class action waiver provision in this arbitration agreement?
Our position, Your Honor, is different from the position that you've articulated today. We believe that Muhammad is not good law, but even if there is
how could that be under New Jersey law? How could Muhammad not be good law?
The Muhammad decision has been implicitly questioned by the Concepcion case.
So under New Jersey law, Concepcion was talking about the FAA. If you want the NJAA to apply, then we're applying New Jersey law. So the U.S. Supreme Court cannot tell us how to interpret our law. So why would the Muhammad case be in any way impaired in our interpretation of the NJAA?
Simply because the FAA and the NJAA are, according to Kernahan, in synchronicity. And in Attlees, Your Honor, you wrote that the two statutes are nearly identical. So our position is, given that harmony, given that near identity between the two statutes, given the fact that the Supreme Court in AT&T versus Concepcion indicated that in California that type of a waiver provision is unconscionable under or unenforceable under FAA.
This raises an interesting
position.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
I had a similar question. Did the Supreme Court tell California that it wasn't going along with its interpretation of California law on unconscionability in this area?
It was brought up under the FAA. It was specifically addressing a California statute.
It was enforcing the supremacy clause. This is federal law, and therefore it knocked down the California law. Once we take the FAA out of the picture, we're not dealing with the supremacy clause any longer. We're just dealing with New Jersey law.
So,
and New Jersey law, and until this court says otherwise, is Muhammad. And Muhammad says that these types of class action waivers are unconscionable.
Let me address that, Your Honor, if I could. The same day that the Muhammad case came down, the Delta case came down as well. And in that case, the Supreme Court enforced a class action waiver in a mortgage loan context. I would also point out that in the Muhammad case, the reason why it's not controlling here is because one of the factors the court relied on was the pittance in the damages that could be recoverable in an action such as the one that Muhammad was bringing. The same point was made in the Iliadis case. That is, the court indicated that the policy behind the Muhammad case was the nominal damages that were at issue. Not so here. What we have here is back pay. We have pre- and post-judgment interest that's being requested, attorney's fees, court costs, as well an enhancement value. So it's distinguishable from Muhammad.
Okay, maybe. What's the value of any individual claim in this case.
There's no ad damnum clause, so it's difficult. But it's obviously the statute of limitations is at least 2 years for the drivers in question. And
so the reason I raise that is for the reasons that you've raised in terms of Iliadis and Muhammad. It's difficult to find attorneys who are willing to undertake the prosecution of small claims. And that's the whole rationale behind class actions, is the aggregations of small claims to encourage attorneys to undertake these cases.
And I agree with you, Your Honor, on that, but such is not this case. This is not a case where we're talking about nominal damages and a plaintiff's counsel needing a significant incentive to round up members of a class to bring a case such as this.
Let me just ask you, just to follow up, I want to understand your position with respect to Concepcion versus Muhammad. If, and I know you're contesting this, if in fact these plaintiffs are out of the FAA by virtue of Section 1, is there a preemption argument that can be made to support the application of Concepcion to essentially nullify the court's holding in Muhammad? If there's no FAA application, whether they chose it or not, does Concepcion have any impact?
I don't think so. I don't think our position is that the FAA is not preemptive except where the state law statute is anti-arbitration. So in that sense, especially where the FAA applies, but I hear Your Honor's question, assuming it doesn't apply, does that rule under Kindred Nursing Centers of not permitting any anti-arbitration law to come out of the states, that would ordinarily apply in the Muhammad case, which was Concepcion, but here the FAA does not apply, so I would have to concede that there is a question as to the continued vitality of the Muhammad case.
And so obviously there's a remand under the appellate division's decision for your case to determine whether they're in or out of the FAA.
Yes.
But if they are out, we should look at Muhammad without, I mean, obviously can read Concepcion as its analysis, but as not governing law here. We should look at Muhammad and decide whether, for reasons given by both parties, as to whether this case is the same case, rather than holding up Concepcion as the benchmark.
Yes, and I would add that I think there are now at least two cases where that issue or a similar issue has been addressed by the Appellate Division of the Supreme Court, where the court has indicated that's the province of the legislature. If Muhammad is going to be extended beyond consumer class actions, let the legislature act. And the legislature has not acted in that area.
Do you agree that Muhammad, though, was speaking about the policies that were being promoted through a class action proceeding in both arbitration as well as court litigation? That was a significant difference, I think, in Muhammad than in the California case that went up to the Supreme Court. And I believe our federal courts have noted that difference. Do you agree?
I do agree that there is, the court found that there was significant value in permitting in consumer class actions the parties to proceed on a class basis for purposes of economics and actually finding, as the Chief Justice has indicated, counsel to represent the parties.
Right. And you're right, Delta was the same day, not a consumer fraud action as Muhammad was.
And upheld the class arbitration waivers.
Correct, it did.
Yeah. I would just make one point with respect to the cases that Your Honors have referenced, especially Justice LaVecchia, the cases cited in the briefs responding to the amicus's brief holding post-New Prime that state laws would govern the arbitration proceedings where the workers were engaged in interstate commerce. And you'll note in some of those cases, the court held that it would be the state arbitration law that would apply, notwithstanding the fact that the parties did not refer to the state arbitration law. They referred to state law, which is our case here.
So, I know that the cases currently seem to argue that state law isn't preempted. But I want you to try to explain to me why Congress, in 1925, at a time when there weren't probably any state laws concerning arbitration, given that ours wasn't passed until 1960, why in 1925 Congress would say, we don't want our Section 2 to apply this arbitration enhancing law to apply to interstate transportation workers, but we'll let every other state in the union do the very thing that we won't do with Section 2. Like, why would they do that?
Well, there's the first thing that, and again, I can't read Congress's mind from 1925, but there's the obvious issue of there are going to be some workers who are not going to be, who are going to be engaged in transportation, but not engaged in interstate transportation. Okay, so those,
We're just talking about interstate. Because they only spoke about interstate. Why would they say we're not going to have our pro-arbitration Section 2 provision apply, but why don't you 50 states do the very thing that we've decided not to do?
Probably in reliance, Your Honor, on the assurance that the states would not act, that there was no, that the only action pending in any legislature at that time was pending in federal.
Yeah, they weren't worried.
They were worried that the states were going to
act. We didn't get around to passing our FAA until 1960.
Right.
Or NJAA, rather.
What do you think this provision adds to an arbitration agreement, apart from these obviously heavily disputed issue as to whether it impacts the meaning of the minds here and what the impact is? But if an FAA provision is in an arbitration agreement, I will candidly tell you I haven't seen this before this case, what does it do for the parties?
Absolutely nothing.
There's the answer.
If you're any attorney in the area of labor law and employment law who needs to contest or challenge a labor arbitration award is going to go to court under both the FAA and the Labor Management Relations Act, regardless of whether the labor agreement or the arbitration award makes any reference to the FAA. And if the FAA is inapplicable by its terms, then the default would be to go into court under the NJAA and the Labor Management Relations Act. So we see that, and again, just repeating myself, the FAA language here, it's a single reference and does not indicate that the FAA is the governing law.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I would like to point out to the court just a couple of comments as to how the facts in our case are a bit different from the facts in the Arafa Health Express case. In the Health Express case, there is no dispute that the drivers were engaged in interstate commerce. I've already pointed out the fact that that is contested in this case. The FAA language in the Health Express arbitration agreement is different. There it says the agreement is governed by the FAA, as opposed to the SDS agreement, the parties agree to comply with and be bound by the FAA, which we believe is more likely to connect up to New Jersey law and the New Jersey arbitration agreement. It's not exclusive of New Jersey law. The provisions work in harmony. The Health Express agreement has no separate governing law provision. The agreement here provides that New Jersey law governs the agreement. Both agreements contain a severability clause, but Your Honors will note that the agreement, in our case, has a very robust reformation provision. And that's exactly what the appellate division did. And again, the appellate division did not rewrite the agreement. The appellate division enforced the reformation clause in the party's agreement. the SDS agreement alerted the drivers to their opportunity to review the agreement with counsel. And there's no similar provision in the Health Express agreement. Unless there are any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Satarajan, rebuttal. I'd like to ask you to respond to Mr. McGovern, who answered the question about when preemption was previously raised. Can you tell us when and how it was raised before the Appellate Division? Because it's not in their opinion, of course.
I believe it was raised. My recollection is raised sua sponte by the court. That's my recollection.
I'm sorry, sua sponte by the court?
Yeah.
You mean they asked a question about it?
Yeah, they asked a question that came in the opinion. That's my best recollection.
So it was not raised by the parties in this litigation?
No, I don't have. I could supplement and provide an answer if it was in our briefs or not. I don't recall at the top. I don't recall, and I want to.
We can find it ourselves. I just wanted to ask you as the architect here.
Your Honor, a couple points here that I kind of hit me as Mr. McGovern was making his presentation. The first is that the cases of Moon v. Breathless, the requirements of Garfinkel, were not addressed. Your Honor, this is a case where people this contract was asking people to forfeit their statutory rights, that their right to go to court to enforce their statutory rights. Contracts have been voided under that basis. Under Moon, under Garfinkel, requirements are there. This provision does not make any mention of that. As of that, this contract is void. This is a hugely important issue. This court has established as a matter of basic contract formation, underlying arbitration agreements, is that these people who sign these agreements have to know that they're forfeiting their rights to walk into a courthouse in the state and enforce their statutory rights. That's a powerful thing they're giving up. And this court has said if they're going to do that, it has to be clear. That has been said time and time again by this court. It's been said most recently in the Third Circuit in a similar legal case.
So in the limited time we have on rebuttal, would you like to respond to any of the arguments?
Yes, I would like. Counsel made a point that this case didn't involve nominal damages because this case for not failure to pay overtime. I believe there's a case, a wage payment case for deductions. You could have class members who only worked for a week or 2 weeks, and that they would have very minimal damages as opposed to people who didn't work the entire 2 years. So to say that there couldn't be parties that don't have nominal damages would not be accurate. And
I just want to ask you a question about your reference to Garfinkel. So I'm looking at the arbitration agreement. Claims covered by this agreement. And it has A, B, C, D. I'm just looking at C. And C is disputes arising out of or relating to payments made to contractor for services provided. Then it goes to disputes arising out of or relationship to any other aspect of contractor's relationship with the company, past or present, whether arising under federal, state, or local statutory, regulatory, and or common law. Like, why doesn't that satisfy Garfinkel?
No, I'm looking at Cologne. I believe you may be looking at Arafa.
Am I looking at the wrong one?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm looking at Arafa. Okay, I'm sorry.
Scared me for a second.
Okay. I don't know why I had it in front of me. Okay, thank you.
All right.
But same language, any dispute, difference, question, or claim, very broad, arising out of or in any way related to this agreement. And this is an agreement for employment.
But there's
or
no
transportation services.
If you look at the, I'm sorry.
Are you pointing to the fact that statutory claim is not mentioned?
It's not mentioned. Statutory claims doesn't give examples of the type of claims that they will be giving up.
Okay.
And absent a reference to statutory claim or constitutional claim, your position is the agreement doesn't cover it.
Correct. And it says arising out of the agreement, where it doesn't raise their separate independent rights. It's the only rights under the agreement, which under Moon and under this court's prior jurisprudence would not be.
I guess you can point to ARAFA as the proper way you can do it.
Correct. I didn't make this argument there.
Thank you, counsel.
And we need a break before the next.
Okay, we'll take a short recess and come back for ARAFA. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.